and I'm an alcoholic. I was just going to ask how long you wanted me to go, but I got a text saying, go as long as I want. So good. We'll be here 4 or 5 hours. I do want to thank you guys for asking me to participate. I was looking at your flyer of this journey through the steps you're going to take. And it's a really, aside from tonight, it's a really powerful lineup of some really, some people that I greatly admire, not for how they talk, but for what they do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I also want to, so it's customary at my home group. We always open with our sobriety date because of God AA sponsorship. My sobriety date is March 16th, 1992. And that means that in March I celebrated 28 years of consecutive sobriety. And that's important. And it's important for two reasons. One, because prior to coming to AA, I had had a 2-year stint where I quit drinking on my own. And the longest that I've ever been able to put together on my own is 2 weeks. So I know what I'm capable of, and it's not much. And I know what I'm capable of if I'm here with you. I also like to bring it up because COVID hit the week of my birthday. And so when I was going to take my cake, that's when we canceled our meeting and have not met since. So, by God, I'm going to mention it everywhere I go on Zoom until I get to have a cake somewhere. I do want to, I was listening, you know, to the chatter that takes place, prior to the meeting. Welcome, by the way, to those of you who raised your hand for being new. In particular, I wanted to congratulate, I think I'm getting the name right, Pat mentioned that he was celebrating, 90 days of sobriety tonight. That's a big deal. That's a big deal under any circumstances. But, you know, when you look at the past 90 days, I got to tell you, Pat, that's impressive. I honestly would argue we should give you a 6-month chip just for being able to maintain sobriety throughout all this. And I don't hate Zoom. I don't bash Zoom. I actually, in fact, when this is all over, when this is all over, I was planning on writing a letter to Zoom and just thanking them that this platform was available to us. I will say, if you've ever been anywhere during the Lord's Prayer, sometimes they'll unmute everyone, and you've got all this, you know, off key. That really is what I'm like. If you really want to know what I'm like, just listen to the Lord's Prayer at any Zoom meeting where voices are going 100 miles different directions. It's kind of what it's like in my head. My job tonight is to discuss with you step one, and I will do the best of my ability to share my experience, strength, and hope when it comes to that. I guess what I would share right off the outset is that the biggest barrier for me coming into Alcoholics Anonymous was the deep-seated belief that I'm not really an alcoholic. Now, when I say that, in today's terminology, sometimes people want to accuse me of being in denial. Denial is a word that's been made popular by treatment centers. It is not what our book talks about. Our book talks about something called delusion. Now, what's the difference? Quite frankly, it's this. When I was about 30 years old, which was 20 years ago now, when I was about 30 years old, I started to go gray, right? And I would look in the mirror and I would say to myself, oh, my hair is getting lighter. It must be from the sun. And I live in Fargo. We don't have any sun. I knew what was going on, but I pretended that that's what it was, right? That my hair is lightening because of the sun, because I didn't really want to admit that I was going gray. So that is denial, right? Denial implies I know the truth, but I'm pretending it's not there. Delusion means that I buy the lie. When I say that I'm not an alcoholic, I genuinely believe that to my core. I would pass a lie detector test. In fact, I believe it so strongly that if I'm not careful, I will die from that delusion by continually, you know, not acknowledging what's truly wrong with me. I can't find any help. And the reason that I was so convinced that I was not an alcoholic is quite simple. We all know what an alcoholic is. An alcoholic is somebody who they drink too much. They can't handle their liquor. They get drunk, and eventually they get drunk often enough and frequently enough that they start to have problems in their life because of their drinking. Because of their drinking, they develop a host of defects of character. Because of their drinking, they have problems in their marriage. Because of their drinking, they have problems at work, and they have problems with their emotional disposition. And if they can find a way to somehow magically sober up, they return to normal living, right? You hear it. Sometimes you hear it from a podium in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, after I finally quit drinking, suddenly I skipped into work to accept numerous promotions, and, you know, multiple families have now returned to me and all of this great stuff because I am no longer drinking. Now, my problem was something far deeper and far worse. And I know that because I had problems long before I ever drank. There's been something wrong with me at my core for a long time. And I've never known how to articulate it. I've never known what it is. I've just known I feel odd in my skin, right? I don't feel like I fit in this world, in this skin, with you. Just something always seems... Thank you. I see someone sent me a digital birthday cake. Now I'm happy. Now I'm going to let that resentment go. Something has just felt off with me all my life. And I never would have ever attributed it, any of it, to alcoholism, right? But here's what it's like to be me. I have an extremely racy mind, and it's constantly going, right, 1,000 miles an hour. And I overanalyze everything, and I take everything that's going on around me very personal. You know, being a selfish and self-centered individual, everything is about me, and I feel emotions very intensely. What that means is I don't get happy, I get ecstatic. I don't get blue, I get depressed or suicidal. I don't get perturbed by things, I get rageful. And oftentimes I can just bounce from one emotion to the next, depending upon what's going on. I remember I'm very sensitive. And I spend a lot of time getting my feelings hurt for all kinds of absurd things. And when I was like 19, I was meeting a therapist, and I was explaining to her, you know, how sensitive I am and how I get my feelings hurt. And I remember saying, you know, it's not uncommon that if people are saying mean things to you, that, you know, you would get your feelings hurt. And it's like, yeah, but nobody's actually saying anything to me. She's like, well, then what is it that's causing your feelings to get hurt? And it's like, it's just a feeling. I can just tell people want to say mean things. I can tell by their looks, body language. You know, I'm a comparer. I noticed that when you came into the room, you hugged everyone else, and then you shook my hand, you know, what the hell. And I've just always inherently been able to sense rejection before it actually came. And it's hard to express this to people, right? You just sound crazy. So you learn early on just not to talk about any of this stuff, and just to kind of fake your way through life. You know, having a perception problem like I do, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. You know, I'm the kind of guy that can walk into a hotel and the front desk clerk, who's just doing her job, you know, smiles at me, and I think there's something there. I feel electricity in the air. I'm like, she don't smile at everybody like that, let me tell you. Here we go. And I've got our whole life planned. I can see the house, what our kids will look like. You know, this is it. I finally found her. And my God, you know, this poor girl is just trying to welcome me to the Hampton Inn, and I'm off running, you know, got our marriage planned. And then I see the wedding ring right on her finger, and I crash back to earth. Oh my God, who could ever love me? You know, and it's just, this is what it's like to be me. I have this innate ability that if there was an organ in the body that housed self-esteem, I can do things that fill mine up, but it's got a hole in it, and it's constantly draining. And so I walk around feeling like I'm not enough, feeling like I'm inferior to the people around me. Nobody is saying or doing anything that causes me to feel that way. It's just something I'm born with, and I don't know what to do with any of this stuff. And I should mention, again, this isn't all past tense. You know, sometimes, like, I'm going to get to what I'm like now, and I'm going to tell you that I've never felt that way since. Not true. I still have a perception problem. I still take things very personal, just not as detrimental as it used to be. But case in point, a few years ago, I was flying, and I was going somewhere, and I'm in line getting ready to hand my ticket to the gate agent. And she's having apparently just a great day, right? And she is just welcoming people with zip and pep. And she's like, thank you for flying Delta. You have yourself a great flight. You know, she's rattling off all this stuff. And I'm like, wow, I'm kind of curious to see what she's going to say to me. I mean, hell, I'm flying somewhere to speak at an AA conference. So let me tell you, that's how far along I am in my recovery. And I get up and I hand her my ticket and she looks at it. And she goes, all righty then. And she just hands me my ticket back, right? And I don't know how you respond to that, but I need to find out what is going on. What does all righty then mean? What, have I done something to offend you? I mean, this is just how I'm wired, right? And I never knew what to do with any of this stuff. I never knew there were other people who felt this way. I have spent my life feeling so unique. So, you know, I'm the only one who feels this way. And I've never known what to do with any of it. You know, my sensitivity, again, it borders on absurd. I'm the kind of guy who is deeply offended when I'm not invited to things that I don't want to be at in the first place. And if you don't get that, you know, it's hard to explain to people, but, you know, somebody asks, hey, we're all going over to Ralph's to help him move on Friday. Are you coming, Jeff? No, I wasn't invited. I'm all mopey. Oh, well, do you want to help Ralph move? No, I don't want to help Ralph move. God, no. I want to lie and make up a reason why I can't be there. But I want to be invited. I want to be made to feel like I'm a part of, right? And this is how I am. I'm offended when you compliment the person next to me and not me. I was at an AA conference one time and somebody, oh, that's a beautiful tie, Steve. Steve's sitting next to me. You know, I'm like, what about my tie, right? I'm that guy. You walk on eggshells around. And I hate all of this. I don't want to be like this, but I don't know how to change. I went through a lot of phases thinking that this will be it. And nothing seemed to work. Nothing seemed to stick. I remember I was at a party one time and somebody had pointed out this guy. They're like, that's so-and-so. He doesn't care what anybody thinks. Right. He just marches to the beat of his own drum. And I thought, perfect. That's how I'm going to be. I thought you could just will yourself a new personality. And so I started walking around telling everyone, I don't care what anybody thinks. Right. The problem is that God didn't make me like that. God didn't give me the equipment to not care what anybody thinks. So when you come at me and I'm like, I don't care what anybody thinks. Oh, good. Because Pete doesn't like you. Why? What did I do? Right? I'm just not wired to be this macho guy. And none of this stuff makes me an alcoholic. I want to be really crystal clear on that. It makes me neurotic, but none of this stuff makes me an alcoholic. There has to be one more key factor that needs to take place for me to cross into that. And that is just this. Alcohol has the ability to fix all of that. For a little while, every deficiency I feel, every hole, every inadequacy, alcohol for a little while makes it all better. And that is why alcohol is so magical to me. We tend to focus on all the problems that alcohol brings in AA, and that's understandable, of course. But the question, if we have any, I don't know if we have any non-alcoholics on tonight or not, but if you are, welcome. But if you love an alcoholic, you've looked at them inevitably and thought, what in the hell is your deal? Why do you keep doing this? Can't you see that this is killing you? And the honest answer is, yes, I do see that. I do know that. Why then do I allow alcohol to do all that it does to me? Because long before it started doing something to me, it was doing something for me. And it's magical and it's powerful. And I am willing to pursue that feeling into the gates of insanity or death. It's just that simple. Alcohol does something for me. And what it does for me is it makes me into the person I've always wanted. That's why so many times when I was out drinking, I would say things like, yeah, this is the real Jeff. This is the person that I want to be. I'm intelligent. I'm witty. You know, I'm good with the ladies. I can bond with the guys. I love everything about it. Now, granted, I overdo it. No question about it. We'll get on top of that. But alcohol allows a guy like me to get there. And if you're a real alcoholic tonight on this call, you know where there is, right? I can see some of your eyes lighten up right now. There is a magical place where alcohol takes people like us and makes everything okay for a little while. The best way that I know how to describe it is quite simply way back when, back in my teenage years, you know, somebody talks me into going to a party and I'm, you know, right away I have objections and concerns and they bring me there and I'm looking around and I'm making comparisons and I'm in my own head. And I don't feel very comfortable and I feel inadequate, right? And I look around and I'm like, I'm the only guy here wearing a long sleeve shirt. It's the middle of summer. It's hot. I'm not dressed appropriately. I'm an idiot. I don't know what I'm doing. And then some guy walks into the party and he's cool and got a tank top on and he's got his hat on backwards and everybody seems very excited to see him. So I hate that guy, right? And I'm staring daggers at him. And then she walks into the room and she is the girl of my dreams. She is the girl that I am pursuing. When I say that I'm pursuing her, I don't mean I'm taking any action at all. But I stare at her and think about her a lot. And that doesn't seem to be getting me anywhere. But the simple fact of the matter is I know that a girl like that would never take an interest in a guy like me. If I was to go and muster up the courage to ask her out, she would laugh. The whole party would laugh at me. I would be publicly ridiculed, I mean, and humiliated. And I'm just not going to put myself in that kind of situation. That's who I am sober. And it's uncomfortable and it's painful. But now I start drinking. And by the third or fourth drink, something magical happens. Literally everything starts to look different, right? I feel like I stand up a little straighter. It's like I have some kind of problem with my spine that's suddenly fixed, right? And I stand up a little straighter and the world looks a little clearer. You know, I've heard a lot of great definitions for what alcohol can do for an alcoholic. It can allow me to see color. It can allow me to hear the beat of life. It can do for me, this is an old one, it can do for me what the phone booth does for Clark Kent. They all fit. And I get them, I'm dating myself a little there, but I get them all. And I like how I feel. And suddenly that party looks different. And now I'm going to go start righting wrongs, right? So I'm going to go over to the guy in the tank top with his hat on backwards. And I'm going to let him know, hey, man, about an hour ago, when you got here, there was tension between us, right? Now, he doesn't know there was tension. He doesn't know the neurotic fool in the corner was having an imaginary war with him. But now I'm mouthing off and I'm letting him know, hey, man, if you're looking for trouble, you found it. And I love being like that. I'm going to go find her, right? Except now I am armed with confidence and I go find her and I let her know, listen, I could have anyone I want at this party, male or female, and I am picking you and it's a great honor. And she doesn't seem to reciprocate the interest in me. I'm not humiliated. I'm not publicly ridiculed. I'm not anything. I'm not even bothered by it. I lock her in a bathroom until she comes to her senses. And I don't see anything wrong with my behavior. In fact, I love it. I love being this guy. I love what alcohol does for me. And that's why subconsciously I made a decision. I'm going to do this as often as I can. Now, alcohol is a bad solution. Right? It's a bad solution to my problem because I can't seem to control my intake. Once I start drinking, something happens and I end up getting insanely drunk, much more drunker than I planned to or wanted to. But we'll get that figured out. There's always a reason for that. I'm not going to drink tequila anymore. I'm not going to drink whiskey or I'm not going to drink with him or, you know, but all the while, you know, the great obsession of every alcoholic, the desire to control and enjoy my drinking. I can do one, but not the other. On the very rare occasions I have been able to control my drinking, and I think it's horrible. I don't know why anyone would actually want to do that. To this day, I don't really understand how people do that. Sometimes you see people on planes, they get a drink and they sit there swirling their ice and nursing it. Sometimes they don't even finish it. My God, I have absolutely no desire nor ability to be like that. Conversely, if I am enjoying my drinking, I have far more alcohol than you could ever drink in a night. I'm getting insanely drunk to the point of passing out. And when I wake back up, continuing to drink. And that's my idea of enjoying drinking. But I continued on, you know, I ended up going away to college. You know, another great fallacy is that it will be different somewhere else. When I get there, wherever there is, I'm going to buckle down. I'm going to apply myself. And for me, when I got to college, my goal was to just bury my nose in the books. I wasn't going to worry about what everybody thought. Because that's another thing, you know. And by the way, I've figured out, you know, I've always been so concerned with what everyone thinks. And for the longest time, I wondered, why is that? And it's really nothing mystic. It's just this. If you're incapable of generating your own self-esteem, you become reliant on the people around you to tell you then that you're okay. And for me, I need everyone's buy-in. If I'm in a room with 100 people and you tell me 99 think I'm great, I'm zeroing in on the one who doesn't. And that's just the way that I'm wired. And so I was going to get down to college and it was all going to be different. And the problem is this, I take myself with wherever I go, there I am. and got into the same crowd doing the same thing. And ultimately, what happened for me was I got to a party one night. I drank, passed out, woke up when everyone else was just showing up. I was that guy. And I'm wired in the sense that I hurt. I spend a lot of time hurt. And I'm so petty that if I can't find a way to feel better, then my logic becomes that I want to make you feel as bad as me. And on that particular night, I decided that I wanted everyone to feel as bad as I felt, to hurt like I hurt. And I've been given a gift at times of communication, and you can use that to help and you can use that to hurt. And that particular night, I used every ounce of communication and observation I had to try and hurt as many people as I could. And I was hurling insults at people and just saying vicious, terrible things. And eventually, it got to be, you know, everyone on one side of the party and me all by myself. And this gal stepped forward and she said, "What is the matter with you?" Right? And that question stopped me in my tracks. The simple fact of the matter is that I didn't know. I had no idea what was the matter with me. I know this. I did not have any intention of this happening. I don't want to be saying the things I'm saying. I don't want to be hurting the people I'm hurting. I don't want to be going the places I'm going. I am completely seemingly powerless, though, to stop any of this. And here I am again, one more time, in this situation that I don't want to be in. And that's the best answer that I had. Best answer I had. Now, my answer tonight would be a little different. My answer tonight would be that I suffer from alcoholism. And so it begs the question, how then did I go from being so adamant to suffering from this delusion that I am not an alcoholic to finally coming to understand and believe and make this admission that I am powerless over alcohol, that my life is unmanageable? And I think it's interesting. One of the great things, there's many, one of the great things about Alcoholics Anonymous that I admire is we don't tell people they're alcoholic, right? Even though sometimes I think we should. We may secretly judge you. But if you come into AA and you ask that million-dollar question, am I an alcoholic? The answer is this, we can't tell you. That's not our job. We're not here doing 20 questions. We're not here qualifying people. That's up to you. We give you the dignity to come in and listen and identify. And if you listen long enough and if you stay long enough, if you have what we have, eventually that fateful day comes where you make this admission that, yes, I'm an alcoholic. And in step one, you know, the words that we see on the slides on the wall, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, dash, that our lives have become unmanageable. It's great. It's fine. Quite frankly, if you want a simplified version of that, I have problems when I drink. I have problems when I'm sober. But in chapter three, the book, in my opinion, not my opinion, this is how it's been taught to me. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is laid out very specifically. You have the doctor's opinion that gives a great description of what alcoholism is. But he's not an alcoholic, so it can't consider to be page one. They changed it to Roman numerals. Then you have Bill's story. Bill's story is there for identification. This is me for the first time in my life giving a chance to identify with another alcoholic. And when I know where to look in Bill's story, when I get past the specifics, because I was so crude and stupid that like the first time I read Bill's story, I'm like, I wasn't in World War II. It's like, could you get past that? And could you start to see a little beyond that? But Bill's story is there for identification. Okay, we've presented the problem. We've given you what we think the problem is. We've given you another alcoholic to identify with. Yeah, I think maybe I could have this. Great. Good news. There is a solution. Fantastic. Right? We get into the next chapter. There is a solution. But here's the problem. Bill knew. It's like they knew it. 3 years sober, he knew we were not going to like the solution at all. We're the only people who have a terminal illness and when presented with some kind of a solution, bitch about the solution. Like, I don't know if I really like that. I don't know if I like God and want to do all of that. And so the next chapter, more about alcoholism, I believe, is intentional. It's like, you don't think you need that? Here's more information on how screwed you are. And in the course of that chapter, they're going to walk me through step one. Except the wording that they use is different. And the wording that they're going to use there is we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost self that we were alcoholics. The delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. And that's really what needs to happen for me, is I have to smash that delusion. And I do so by conceding to my innermost self. Now, I'm not here to take shots or pick fights with anyone, but my experience is this. I sometimes hear people say things like, well, I went into a meeting and I admitted I was an alcoholic and that was step one. God bless you if that's your experience. But let me tell you, I can walk into a meeting of damn near anything and admit that I am this just to fit in. But do I believe it or not? And in the book, it's very clear. I have to believe what I'm saying and to believe what I'm conceding. And by conceding, if I'm in an argument with you, we're going back and forth, and eventually I say, I concede the point, means I'm wrong, you're right. And I want to concede this point to myself that this is really what's wrong with me, is that I am an alcoholic. And I have to understand what that means. And through the process of being with you, that's exactly what happened. I came in, and I like to, I heard an expression a few weeks ago. It's an old one, but they used to say it a lot, and I hadn't heard it in a while. But I sat all the way down. I took my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started listening. Somebody gave me the great advice of, hey, Jeff, you have two ears, two eyes, and one mouth. Try shutting up and just listening and observing for a while. Novel concept, right? And in the course of me listening, what I came to discover is this. I started to identify with people. I started to identify with the way that you drink. I started to identify with the way that you thought, with the peculiar mental twist that it precedes the first drink. And eventually, as I said, the day came where I realized, oh my God, I'm an alcoholic. That's what's wrong with me. And when I say that I have alcoholism, I want to be really crystal clear what I mean. Alcoholism to me is a threefold illness. It affects me physically, mentally, and spiritually. Now we'll break it down. In a physical sense, I have an allergy to alcohol. I didn't know any of that. In the book, in the doctor's opinion, it describes it as phenomenon of craving. When my sponsor was taking me through the book, he's like, you know what we mean by phenomenon, right? And I was an idiot, right? I was always embarrassed to admit it. I didn't know anything. So I'm like, yeah, I know what it means. Well, what does it mean? I'm like, well, you know. Yeah, I know. Do you know is what I'm asking. And I'm like, well, it's like, you know, Bigfoot or UFOs and stuff. And he just, I swear to God, my sponsor had a kink in his neck from just rolling his eyes at things I said. And he's like, we're not talking about Bigfoot or UFOs. We're talking about some indescribable feeling that takes place once you start drinking. Now, there's an old proverb that talks about the man takes a drink, and then the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes the man. That's my story in a nutshell. I start drinking with good intentions, right, of just getting there. And once I get there, I'm going on maintenance, right? I'm going to slow down, or I'm going to start drinking water or whatever. But when I start drinking, an allergy of the body takes over, and it causes me to drink way more than I plan to. I didn't know any of that, but I do understand this kind of thinking. I understand getting to my fifth drink thinking, man, I feel good. Can you imagine how much better I would feel with five more? I completely understand that line of thinking, even though it's never worked out that way for me. So there's something wrong. By the way, this has scientifically been proven. This isn't theory. There's something wrong with the way that I process alcohol, right? Calls it an allergy. Now, I like the idea of an allergy. It's simple and it's easy to understand. So let's talk about a different kind of allergy. Let's imagine that every time I eat bananas, let's say I'm allergic to bananas, and every time I eat bananas, I break out in hives. How far down the rabbit hole do you think I'm going with that? Do you think I'm trying to switch brands? Hey, you know, Chiquita bananas caused me to break out in hives, but I'm sure Dole bananas will be completely different. No, I don't lie to people. So I can, you know, I'm just going to go for a walk so I can run down to my corner grocery store and buy a bunch of bananas to strategically hide that around the house. I don't keep bananas in the house in case guests show up and want a banana. I don't want to be rude. I don't keep a banana in my glove box in my car, all warm and mushy, so I can run out there at noon, scarf it down just to get through the day. I don't do any of that, right? What I do is I just quit eating bananas and go on with my life. Yet far worse things happen to me when I drink alcohol than just breaking out in hives. Why can I not stay away from it? What is the problem? And this moves into the second phase of my illness, this mental obsession of the mind. Again, my sponsor pitched that to me. I'm like, no, I don't have that. I don't sit around thinking about drinking all the time. And my sponsor would roll his eyes and be like, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about this concept that you have a mind that over any given period of time, it blocks out all of the reasons why you're not supposed to drink for the insane idea that it will be different this time. I totally get that. Completely get that. I went through a phase. I decided to quit drinking. I don't know. I was 18 or something. And I just told everybody, anyone who would listen to me, I told them I would stop drinking. I thought the more people I tell, the better my chances are for sobriety. And we went out on this road trip, and I'm sitting in the back of this car next to this cooler of beer. And as soon as we got outside the city limits, I crack that cooler, I grab a beer, and I start drinking. And my buddy, who's driving, he's like, "Hey, man, I thought you quit drinking." This was my response. "Yeah, not on road trips." And, you know, that would be insane. And that made perfect sense to me, right? By the way, the kind of people I drink with made sense to them, too. They're like, "Yeah, that'd be extreme." And so that's why I was running again, right? A sober mind leads me back to a drink and gives me some ridiculous excuse on why it will be different this time or why I deserve it or what's the point anyway, whatever the case may be. It leads me back to a drink. And a drink passes my lips and my body processes it differently. A phenomenon of craving develops and I start drinking beyond my control, if you will. It's not a matter of willpower. It's not a matter. It's something inherently is wrong with me. So that begs the question, then how do I stay away from the first drink, which is really what this is all about? Because Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't really tackle the first two components of alcoholism. The physical side, there's really nothing we can do on that. We're not doctors. There's nothing we can do. Even on the mental side, despite sometimes what you hear at meetings, we are not psychiatrists, psychologists, or therapists. We don't really tackle that. What we handle is the third part of the illness, spiritual malady, right? Again, I didn't think that I even had that until it was described to me. But I have been walking around all my life with a hole inside of me. I can feel it. I know it's there. I feel horrifically inadequate. But I am most afraid that the rest of the world is someday going to discover that I am not what I pretend to be, that I am this deficient, incomplete human being who's extremely insecure and extremely reliant upon everyone else. And there's just something wrong with me. Again, I have thought that is a alcohol-shaped hole, a money-shaped hole, a sex-shaped hole, a prestige-shaped hole. And what I've come to believe for me is that it is a God-shaped hole. The bottom line for me is that I am disconnected from something that I cannot be disconnected from. Off to my left, you can't see it, is a lamp. And the lamp is plugged into the wall, and there's wires, I'm sure, in the wall. And eventually these wires go to some power station somewhere where they generate power. All I know is this: if I take the right actions to turn the light on, the light comes on. If I unplug it from the wall, doesn't matter how much journaling or chanting or even praying that I do, it is not going to work because it's disconnected from something that it cannot be disconnected from. Much the same with me. If I am disconnected from this power, I will always, always, as long as I'm sober without a solution, for me, I start to exhibit more and more signs that most people classify as mental illness. I don't. It looks to me like this. I develop increased feelings of restlessness, irritability, and discontentment. My restlessness in the sense that I'm not living the life I'm supposed to be living. There's something wrong. I don't know what it is, but I'm not at the right job. I'm not with the right person. Something needs to change, and I don't know what it is. My irritability, right? I spend a great deal of my time feeling like I do twice as much as everyone else for half of the results. I remember my sponsor telling me that I had a great deal of self-pity. And I was arguing with him. I'm like, "I don't have a lot of self-pity." I didn't even know what it meant. He's like, "Do you understand the definition of self-pity?" I'm like, "No, it's a deep-seated belief that your life is harder than other people's." That I get completely. I've lived that. And I'm sick of it. And I'm sick of feeling this way, and this gets irritable, and I get wound up, and eventually something happens, and I just snap, right? Coincidentally, I've been diagnosed many a times with an anger problem. Again, I would argue for me, it's just a spiritual problem. And then lastly, this discontentment. Nothing ever holds its shine for me very long, and I react very immaturely to things when they're not shiny, because I like things when they're shiny and new. I like jobs in the first 2 weeks. I like new cars. I like new relationships. But I don't seem to like anything long term. Of all the things I've ever done in AA, I think my favorite thing of talking or speaking on was a workshop one time. Somebody said, "Yeah, just make something up and talk about it." I'm like, "All right." So the title of the workshop was "This Isn't It Either." And it's just a series of things that I thought once upon a time were the answer, that I came to that inevitable dead end road of "This Isn't It Either," right? And I can't tell you how many things I've hit that wall with where I've come to the realization this isn't it either. And, I can buy a new car, right? New, brand new red car, drive around. And I'm so shallow and fickle that a car literally makes me feel better about myself. Like everyone's looking at me better. I'm more handsome. I'm smarter, whatever. But about a month into it, I will pull up to a stoplight and somebody will pull up in the exact same car, only theirs is black. And my first thought is, I should have got the black one, right? Just this perpetual state of discontentment. And that's how I am. And according to our book, unless I can find a way to experience a sense of ease and comfort, which I think is a great description for the effect of alcohol on me, ease and comfort, because my life is the exact opposite, hard and uncomfortable. Unless I can find a way to experience ease and comfort, unless I will always just continue this cycle on this hamster wheel, always thinking it's going to somehow be different, and ultimately it's not, and eventually I will die from this. Unless I can find a way to implement a psychic change, a spiritual awakening, a personality change sufficient enough to bring about recovery from alcoholism, casting aside old ideas, attitudes, and outlooks for a completely new set, call it whatever you want. But unless I can find a way to get in touch with this power greater than myself, I'm screwed, right? And I didn't know any of this. I really didn't. And it's a powerful delusion to suffer from. I guess I glossed over. I've had a lot of things happen to me, like all of us have. Some are funny, some are sad. I've been arrested in a foreign country for a deal gone bad is all I want to say about that. I've had two failed suicide attempts. One of them, I attempted an overdose of pills. I attempted to overdose on sleeping pills, but I was so drunk that I took the wrong bottle and ended up ODing on vitamin C. And that's what I ended up going to the psych ward for. I was inadequate in the psych ward. You know, people, you're asking, hey, what are you in here for? Well, I was talking to dogs and stuff. Like, yeah, you belong here. How about you? Overdosed on vitamin C. I mean, God, what a horrible weenie thing to end up in the psych ward for. But ultimately, at the age of 21, I ended up came in at Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I said earlier, I was just beaten down to a point where I would listen. And in listening, I gained what I believe to be the first gift that Alcoholics Anonymous allows for, and that's identification. And with that identification, it eliminates that feeling of loneliness. And if I can do that, then I can get the real gift that AA has. And for you, Pat, for the other people who raised their hand, my hope is this, is that not only you gain that gift of identification, but more importantly, that you gain that gift of hope. This idea that, hey, I seem to have what these people have. Maybe if I do what they do, I could find a way to not only be sober, but seemingly enjoy it, right? Because that's really the thing. I mean, we can sober up under a lot of different conditions, but how do I live free? How do I want to be sober? And that's really been the trick for me for the last 28 years, is how do I live in a world free from temptation, from driving by bars, from seeing all kinds of imagery and movies and TV shows? How do I stay away from it and not allow that mental obsession to get me back? And what I need to do is what you guys are going to be talking about for the next 10 or 11 nights, however long you're going, is continually be working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got into AA, you know, my sponsor was very quick to explain to me that I had to, he told me to look at my recovery like it was one giant room with a lot of exits. And I have to have something posted at all the exits. I have to have a sponsor. I have to have a home group. I have to have a commitment in my home group, a working understanding of the 12 steps, an attempt to be abiding by the 12 traditions, you know, an attempt to be working with others in some capacity. And I need to be doing all these things to ensure that my own sobriety, stays. And, you know, that's exactly what I've done. And look, I'm not going to tell you everything's been rosy ever since. It's been life. That's really what I was promised, was life. And it's been a life with ups and downs, great successes, horrific failures, tragic loss, wonderful additions. It's just been that. It's been a life. And to give you an example of really, if I was to try and encapsulate what my recovery looks like, I think sometimes being alcoholic, we're kind of predispositioned to this idea that everything has to get wonderful for us to feel good. And I found that my recovery is actually not that way at all. I'll tell you what I mean. I'll give you a day. I get up. I'm a little rushed. I don't really pray. I don't connect with God. I just take off to start building my empire. And I'm on my way to work. And where I live, there's construction going on. So two lanes boil down to one, right? In normal civilized society, the way that you're supposed to do it is the old zipper, right? In and out. Well, as we're doing this, some hot dog thinks he's going to come rolling up on the left-hand side and cut the line and then zip in front of me. And not today, Jack, let me tell you. And I'm like, the hell with this guy. I speed up so he doesn't have any room to get in. He has to come to a complete stop because the road sign, right? And I'm like, good, sit back there and think about who you are and what you are. And I'm on my way to work. I'm already starting to feel a little tense. I get to work, and I don't know if you have this ability, but as I walk in, I hear two people over in the corner laughing. And I have an ability to know when laughter is directed at me, right? And I'm looking, I'm like, what the hell are they saying, right? And I get down, I sit down, I'm already starting to feel crabby, I'm inadequate, I'm all these things. So I do what we do, right? It's time to do a big home run, and I send out a big idea to the company. And I do so with expectations, right? I do so, and I mock humility. I'm like, what does everyone else think? That's code for tell me how great an idea this is. And so I send this idea out, and a few people do respond like they're supposed to. And then Jenny responds with this. I don't really agree with Jeff. I think we should do this instead. Got to tell you, now I have a problem with Jenny. Now, I'm a sober spiritual giant, eh? I'm not going to do anything to Jenny. But I do slip into ninja character assassination mode where I start doing this kind of stuff. I'm like, start asking my coworkers, is Jenny doing okay? I just seems like something's off. I'm worried. I'm concerned, you know, if anything I can do. And I start trying to sow seeds of doubt on poor Jenny. And now I'm driving home and I don't feel good. And I don't like my life. You know, I'm thinking about the gifts of sobriety, none of which I seem to have. And the straw that breaks the back is when I get home, there's all these dishes on the counter. My wife at the time is a stay-at-home mom. And really, she doesn't have the time to clean this up. Now I have to come home and do this. Ugh, right? And I feel disgruntled, and I feel like I'm getting shortchanged, and I don't feel like recovery is any gift whatsoever, and I certainly don't feel like I'm rocketed in any fourth dimension. Now, let me give you a different day. Let me show you what recovery really is for me. I get up, except this time I do spend a little time getting in touch with God. I do spend a little time allowing him to come in and direct my thinking. And I leave for work, and we're on the construction, and here comes this guy hot-dogging his way up the left-hand side. My knee-jerk reaction, of course, speed up and cut this guy off. But then I ask myself this. I'm looking at this with one possible narrative, and the narrative is that this guy was waiting for me, and then, oh, hey, there's Jeff. I'm going to speed up and cut him off. Is it possible there's a different narrative, perhaps, right? This is something I've had to learn over and over and over, is to consider the possibility. Is there a different narrative here? Is this possible? Is it possible this guy just got married? Is it possible that he has a new little baby at home? Is it possible he works for somebody unreasonable? Is it possible he was told if he was late one more time, he's going to lose that job, and that's the only income that that family has? Is it possible? Is it possible that I could tap on my brake and give 2 seconds of my day to let this guy in so he can get wherever it is that he needs to go? Why don't I try that and see how it goes? I get to work. I feel a little bit better. I walk in. I see those people or hear those people in the corner laughing. But it sounds different to me, right? Suddenly it doesn't seem like it's directed at me, and I'm able to see it for what it is. And I think this is really nice that I work at a place where people are, you know, they have fun, and we work hard, we play hard, and we support each other, and we have a lot of fun doing it. And I'm really blessed that I get to work here. I send out my big idea, and people start coming back. And Jenny comes back with her, I don't agree with Jeff. I think we should do this. And I'm not going to lie. Even on a spiritual day, I don't like that. But I respond differently to it. And instead of going around and character assassinating Jenny, I investigate, right? And I go to Jenny. I'm like, hey, Jenny, it seemed a little harsh, your response to me. What's going on? She, of course, is baffled by all this. She's like, oh, I'm so sorry, Jeff. It's just you kind of know where you're at in the company, what you want to do. I'm making my move. I'm trying to get a promotion. And I realize a fundamental truth that's true in most situations, but I forget it over and over and over. Jenny's not against me. She's just for herself. Why would I begrudge her the opportunity to try and better herself, right? And the world looks different. And I come home, and I'm feeling pretty good, and I walk in the door, and I see all those dishes on the counter, except this time I recognize what's really going on. My wife is at the park right now with my two little kids, and isn't it nice that my kids get to have a mother who spends that kind of time with them, who invests in them and lets them play? And here's a novel idea. Why don't I clean up the stupid dishes? And someone can erect a statue of me, a GSO, for how altruistic I am. And it's the same day, but it looks different. And what I've come to find with my recovery is not that great things have just started happening and I don't know what to do with all the money I make. It's not been about that at all. In fact, I would submit this. I think there's beauty all around us. I think if you're here tonight with us with one day sober, and you may feel like you're in the deepest of holes and you got to get somewhere for things to be better, I would actually submit there's beauty all around you. It's all around you right now. The problem is not that I need to go find it. The problem is that I need to see it. That's the problem. What I need to do is become awakened. And that's really what we're doing in the process of this step, is I'm trying to find a way to awaken into my own life, into my own recovery, and see the many great gifts and experiences that God has put before me. This idea, I'm going to give you a story and then I'm going to shut it down. But to give you an idea of what I'm talking about with these gifts, a few years ago, I was on this kick about happy, joyous, and free. And I was sitting there thinking about it one day, and I'm like, what does that really mean? I mean, I understand freedom, freedom from the bondage of self, freedom from the mental obsession of the mind to drink alcohol. I get that. But what about happy and joy, happiness and joy? I mean, they sound an awful lot alike, and I want to make sure that I'm getting three different things here. And so I started asking around, and I found out, and a lot of people didn't seem to know what the difference was. I had an experience happen years ago that really illustrated it to me. My son was like 15 at the time, and he really wanted a laptop, and he'd asked for one, and we told him we couldn't get it, we couldn't afford it, whatever. But of course, we'd gotten him the laptop, and we wrapped it in an oversized box, and you know, to throw him off the scent. And it's the gift you tuck away in the corner. It's the last one we opened that night. And when the time finally came, I'm watching my son open this. And when he dawned on him, when he realized that it was a laptop, man, the look on his face was pure happiness, right? Just pure happiness. And then I looked over at his mother watching him, and the look on her face was pure joy. And it was then and there I realized what we get here. Happy, joyous, and free. We get to be happy. I mean, sometimes things do go your way. Sometimes every light is green. Sometimes the girl says yes. Sometimes the boss calls you in to tell you good job. Not my experience, but I've sponsored people who've had it happen. But we also get to experience joy, right? You ever heard someone say, if I'd have made a list of things that I wanted when I got here, I'd have sold myself short? I've always thought, really? What the hell kind of list are you making? But here's why I've come to subscribe to that very thinking. I would have never known to even put anything like joy on there. I didn't know it was even capable for me to experience it. I have had so many things happen to me in Alcoholics Anonymous where I have witnessed the power of this program, the power of one alcoholic talking to another, the power of God, where I'm not benefiting at all, but I feel this elation, this lightness, this privilege to be able to watch it. And I really believe that I have come to have passed the gift of being happy, joyous, and free. And the reason that all of this has come to happen for me is that I've developed a relationship, a relationship that's still changing, like any relationship. I've been married for 24 years. My wife and my relationship is not the same as it was at a year sober, nor is my relationship with God the same that it was when I was a year sober. It's evolving and changing and organic, and I come to know more as I go. But for right now, I'm very grateful for the relationship that I have. It's a relationship that I can rely upon and draw from as needed, as the inevitable chaos and calamity, most of it self-induced, come up in my life. And it all started with an admission that in and of myself, I am not enough. This horrible, ego-deflating, at the time seemingly humiliating admission that would start me on a journey to freedom and strength and courage. And that's what it's been. But I had to get myself out of the way. I had to come to this belief and concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. And once I did that, I was able to start the rest of the journey, which you're going to hear about in the nights to come as to what I did. So with that, I think I'm going to wrap it up just a little bit early. I thank you so much for having me. I ask that God keep you and bless you until then. Thanks.